From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Blackwater down? The Iraqi government bans the American security firm from operating in Iraq following an attack Iraq says killed up to 11 civilians. Is Blackwater subject to Iraqi law? Is it subject to U.S. military law? Is it subject to any law in Iraq? We'll host a debate. Then a Louisiana state appeals court has thrown out the conviction of Michael Bell, one of the Gina Six. Bettina Jones, the mother of another of the six, Bryant Purvis, is still waiting for her son to be arraigned. She doesn't have much hope in the local justice system.
I don't think my son could get a fair trial here, not in Gina.
My son has been charged with a crime that he didn't commit, and I want everyone to know that he's not guilty of anything, hasn't done anything wrong.
We'll go to Gina, Louisiana, to speak with Tina Jones. We'll also hear from Michael Bell's attorney, Lewis Scott. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN nuclear watchdog chief, Mohammed El-Baradei, is warning no military action should be taken against Iran and that threats of war are premature and counterproductive. On Sunday, France warned it was preparing for a possible war against Iran, and the Telegraph of London reported the Pentagon's developed a list of up to 2,000 bombing targets in Iran. El-Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said there's no evidence of ongoing prohibited nuclear or nuclear-related activities in Iran.
I have repeated that we have not seen any undeclared facilities operating in Iran. We have not seen any concrete evidence that the Iran program is being weaponized. We have not received any information to that effect. So I haven't heard any other information to the contrary. So while we're still concerned about the nature of the Iranian program, we should not. I do not believe at this stage that we are facing clear and present danger that require that we go beyond diplomacy.
El-Baradei also urged the world to remember what happened in Iraq before considering any similar action against Tehran. Meanwhile, congressional Democrats are being accused of drafting a misleading and erroneous report on Iran's nuclear program. El-Baradei said the congressional report released by Democratic Congressmember Rush Holt of New Jersey contains serious distortions of the IAEA's own findings on Iran's nuclear activity. The report claimed Iran had enriched uranium to weapons-grade level when the IAEA had only found small quantities of enrichment at far lower levels. President Bush nominated retired federal judge Michael Mukasey on Monday to replace Alberto Gonzalez as the nation's 81st attorney general.
Judge Mukasey is clear-eyed about the threat our nation faces. As a judge and a private lawyer, he's written on matters of constitutional law and national security. He knows what it takes to fight this war effectively, and he knows how to do it in a manner that is consistent with our laws and our Constitution.
President Bush made the announcement in the Rose Garden while standing next to Michael Mukasey.
Helping to protect our security, which the Justice Department shares with the rest of our government, is not the only task before us. The Justice Department must also protect the safety of our children, the commerce that assures our prosperity, and the rights and liberties that define us as a nation. I look forward to meeting with members of Congress in the days ahead, and if confirmed, to working with Congress to meet our nation's challenges.
President Bush called on the Senate to confirm Mukasey by October 8th. Democratic Senators Patrick Leahy of Vermont and Charles Schumer of New York avowed to delay the confirmation unless the White House turns over documents about the firing of 9 U.S. attorneys and the Bush administration's secret domestic wiretapping program. The Iraqi government has announced it'll review the status of all private security companies working in Iraq following a shootout Sunday involving employees from the company Blackwater that left up to 11 civilians dead. On Monday, Iraq's Interior Ministry announced it has revoked Blackwater's license to operate in Iraq. The State Department is now attempting to prevent the Iraqi government from expelling Blackwater. On Monday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and vowed the U.S. will investigate the fatal shooting. While Iraqis blamed Blackwater for the civilian deaths, the company said it acted appropriately, quote, in response to a hostile attack by armed insurgents. State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick said he had no information about any Iraqi laws Blackwater or its employees might be subject to. We'll have more on Blackwater after headlines. On Monday, former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan said the removal of Saddam Hussein had been essential to secure world oil supplies. Greenspan said that had the U.S. not gone to war in Iraq, the cost of oil would be much higher.
If the war in Iraq was all about oil, some people say, then why are we facing $80 a gallon right now, a barrel right now? You make the point that if we hadn't gone to war, we might be facing $130, $140 a barrel, correct?
Correct.
And you think that would have been a real possibility?
Absolutely. The way I read Saddam, that's where he was going.
In his newly published memoirs, Greenspan writes, quote, I am saddened it is politically inconvenient to acknowledge what everyone knows. The Iraq war is largely about oil. In campaign news, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has unveiled her proposal to expand health insurance to the 47 million uninsured Americans. Clinton said she would require that all families purchase health insurance and offer them a range of private plans as well as a public option similar to Medicare, which would also continue. The Washington Post reports Clinton's $110 billion plan is similar to proposals offered by Senator Barack Obama and former Senator John Edwards. Clinton's new plan would expand government funding for programs for low-income adults and children, and it would require employers to either insure their workers or pay a tax. Her proposal would also require insurers to offer health care coverage to any person who applies for it. Meanwhile, Congressmember Dennis Kucinich has accused Democratic Party leaders in Iowa of excluding him from two presidential events this week. On Sunday, six of the Democratic candidates were invited to speak to over 12,000 Democratic voters at Senator Tom Harkin's steak fry. But Kucinich and former Senator Mike Gravel were not invited. They also weren't invited to a recent Democratic presidential forum in Davenport, Iowa. Kucinich said, quote, when party leaders and their allies pre-select which candidates they'll allow the voters to hear, it's a disservice to the voters. Iowans deserve better than a rigged game, he said. Two young climate change activists are making a 17,000-mile trek from the North Pole to the South Pole to highlight how the world is changing through global warming. So far, they've cycled, skied, sailed, and walked. On Friday, James Hooper and Rob Gauntlet crossed the U.S.-Mexico border on bicycles. The expedition took off at the geomagnetic North Pole on April 8th. This is 19-year-old James Hooper.
We've had some amazing reactions. I mean, the whole point of the trip is to try and involve as many people as possible, to try and encourage people to understand about global warming. In the Arctic, the sea ice has thinned by 50% in the last 20 years, and in area it's actually shrunk by about 30 to 40% in the last 10 years. So, I mean, there's massive changes going on, and we want to make people aware of those.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Gina, Louisiana, where thousands of people are expected to gather Thursday to protest the charges against six African-American high school students. Last week, the Louisiana Third Circuit Court of Appeals threw out the conviction of 17-year-old Michael Bell. The court ruled he should not have been tried as an adult. Bell was supposed to have been sentenced for attempted second-degree battery this Thursday. Michael Bell and five other students were arrested for beating a white student during a schoolyard fight last December. The fight occurred after white students hung three nooses on a tree in the schoolyard. Bell has been jailed since January, unable to meet his $90,000 bond. As of this morning, he remains in prison waiting for his new bond to be posted. The Associated Press is reporting that District Attorney Reed Walters plans to appeal Bell's overturned conviction at the Louisiana Supreme Court. Lewis Scott is the lead attorney for Michael Bell. He joins us on the phone right now from Monroe, Louisiana. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. How you doing?
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us the status? What happened with Michael Bell's conviction?
It was overturned by the Third Circuit on the basis of the fact that he was only 16 at the time of the charge. So therefore, he should not have been tried in Louisiana as an adult. As a matter of fact, the charges that he was convicted of were not charges that an individual can be charged as an adult for if they're under 17 years old.
Can you go back and explain this case to us? We've been covering it on Democracy Now. We've just returned from Gina, Louisiana. We're going to be playing an interview with one of the moms in a minute of the Gina Six. But explain what happened and why Michael Bell was tried first and separately.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know why the district attorney chose to try Michael first. By the time I entered the case, the trial was already over. So I entered the case about June or early July of this year, and at the time he had already been convicted. But I've not been able to determine why he was tried first.
So you have this situation where last September a black student asked the principal if black students could sit under the tree in the Gina schoolyard. The principal says yes. The black students go to sit under the tree. The next day, the three nooses are hung. Some students are suspended for a couple of days. Tensions mount. It goes for a few months. Then one of the Gina Six, Robert Bailey, goes to a party. He's beaten up by whites. In the next few days, he goes to the local convenience store, the Gotta Go, and one of those white men has a weapon. Robert grabs it from him, runs home. Then the next day is the schoolyard fight, and six African-American students are charged. They're charged with second-degree attempted murder, facing each 100 years in jail. Michael Bell is tried first. He refuses the plea bargain. And so they drop the attempted murder charge, but charge him with aggravated battery and said the dangerous weapon was his tennis shoes. And he is convicted by an all-white jury from an all-white jury pool and facing 22 years in jail. You then came into the picture after he was convicted. And now the judge, before the court, throughout the conviction, said that they were going to drop the conspiracy charge. Is that right? He was charged with conspiracy and aggravated battery.
Yes, what happened, the district judge threw out the conspiracy and the Third Circuit threw out the aggravated second-degree battery. So you had one charge thrown out at a district level, one charge thrown out at the appellate level.
Why is Michael Bell still in jail? The other students, one after another, eventually got out of jail as they their families tried to remake the bail. Theo Scholl was the last of them to be released just recently. But why Michael still in jail?
Well, after Michael was convicted, his bail was revoked. And then after that, the cases were thrown out. At the present time, our position is that he should not be in jail. However, he does have one juvenile charge of conspiracy still pending against him as a result of him being charged with that charge after the Third Circuit threw out the adult conspiracy charge. So therefore, he's being held in jail now. And I'm not exactly sure what the reasoning is, but that's a part of what we're challenging at the present time.
Why was he charged as an adult?
Well, I can only speculate at that. But what happened was he was first charged with attempted murder, which is a charge that you can be charged as an adult for. And then the attempted murder was downgraded to aggravated second-degree battery. Aggravated second-degree battery is not a charge that you can be charged as an adult for. So it's possible that the purpose was a procedural maneuver to charge the greater charge, to change the jurisdiction, and then try to keep the jurisdiction in the district court rather than in the juvenile court. But I would only have to speculate regarding the motivations in charging that and then reducing it.
Can you explain, Lewis Scott, how it was that all of these young people were charged with attempted second-degree murder originally, and still some, facing 100 years in jail, and the response in the GINA community?
I wasn't quite able to understand what you said, or the last question.
How the boys were charged with second-degree attempted murder, facing 100 years each in prison originally.
Well, in Louisiana, the district attorney has a lot of discretion in determining what charge he's going to charge. But again, to answer that question, I would have to deal with the motivations of someone else in order to answer the question. So I really can't answer that question regarding what the district attorney's motivation was in charging such a tremendous crime in this particular circumstance.
Now, the DA, the district attorney, Reed Walters, after the nooses were hung from the tree, and then the black students protested and all went to stand under the tree, came in with police, according to teachers and students, to the school. They held an assembly, and he warned the students. He said, "I could wipe out your lives with the stroke of a pen." And then you have the schoolyard fight, and he charges them with attempted second-degree murder. Michael Bell's charged. He is convicted by an all-white jury from an all-white jury pool. And he faces first 20 years, and then when they drop the conspiracy charge, something like 15 years. His original lawyer did not bring up one witness in Michael's defense. Will you be charging incompetent counsel in that case? He had a public defender.
Well, it's not up to us to charge, but that was one of the things we were investigating. We won't actually be going any further with that because that entire charge was thrown out. So that was something that we were looking into prior to the time that the Third Circuit made its ruling. But after the Third Circuit made its ruling, then that pretty much gave us the opportunity for a new trial without dealing with all of those issues. So that was something that we were investigating into, but at the present time, it's not something that we are dealing with under the present circumstance.
If Michael Bell is charged as a juvenile, what does he face?
Maximum up to 21.
Years?
Up to his 21st birthday, I'm sorry.
Up to the age of 21. And he has been in jail now for, almost 10 months. He was a football star. They expected a lot of Michael going on to college on a football scholarship. Have you visited Michael? What are his spirits like in jail?
Well, they range from being cautiously optimistic to being optimistically cautious. He's happy over certain things that happen, but then there are other things that cause him to feel like things are not going very well, mainly because he hadn't been able to have his freedom. So I think that's what bothers him most. So he may be happy about good decisions and things of that nature, but he doesn't really feel the full impact of that unless he's released.
Lewis Scott, what is the impact of the public exposure of this case as it grows around the country and then the protests? This one on Thursday, there are many people expected to show up in GINA, Louisiana.
Again, I wasn't able to hear.
What is the impact of the public exposure and the public protests, this large protest expected for the day? It was expected that Michael Bell would be sentenced. Now unclear what will happen with the overturning of the decision and the district attorney saying he will appeal.
Well, I intentionally try not to evaluate the impact of things of that nature. What I try to do is to concentrate on the legal effort to make sure that everything is done legally, but then I don't really get involved in determining how what is done in the public will affect the legal process.
Well, we will certainly follow what happens. We're just back from Gina. I want to thank you very much. We hope to talk to you again. Lewis Scott, the new attorney for Michael Bell, who remains in jail. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll talk to the mothers of one of the Gina Six, and then we'll have a debate on the role of Blackwater in Iraq. The Iraqi government says they're throwing the security company out. Stay with us.
What a train that I am holding, man. What a train that I am holding. What a train.
Prettiest Train, recorded live by Alan Lomax. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. I was in Gina, Louisiana earlier this month and visited Gina High School. Gina High School courtyard, standing in front of, well, where the infamous tree once stood. This is the tree where last September, after black students asked the school authorities if they could sit under its shade, the next day, nooses appeared hanging from its branches. In the last few weeks, authorities cut the tree down. Well, 1 year after the nooses were hung from the tree, the case of the Gina Six is drawing thousands to the small town of Gina, Louisiana, this Thursday in protest. Michael Bell is the only one of the Gina Six who remains in prison, but it's been 10 months since the boys were arrested for the schoolyard fight. 17-year-old Bryant Purvis hasn't even been arraigned. The court has just set his arraignment date for the first week of November. He's the only remaining member of the Gina Six to be charged as an adult with attempted second-degree murder. I spoke to Bryant Purvis's mother, Tina Jones, at her house earlier this month. We met on her front porch in Goodpine, an all-black community just outside Gina. Bryant Purvis was expelled from Gina High School and is now studying in Dallas, Texas. He's living with his uncle, Jason Hatcher. Hatcher grew up in Gina. He plays professional football for the Dallas Cowboys. I began by asking Tina Jones to explain what her son has been charged with.
He's charged with second-degree attempted murder and conspiracy to commit second-degree attempted murder.
Tell me about the whole lead-up to the schoolyard fight. What happened in September when the kids first went to school?
Justin Purvis, which is Brian Purvis's cousin, asked the principal if they could sit under this tree where normally white kids sit, and the principal told him that anybody could sit under the tree. So Justin, along with my son Brian and several other kids, went under the tree and sit and stood or whatever. And the next morning, they came to school and found nooses hung from the tree.
And what did they do?
Well, my son, he didn't know about it at first, and when he did go to see
the noose part of the rope had been cut off and just the rope itself was hanging. But when I found out about it, it was at work from some of the other parents talking about it. Brian didn't come home and tell me. So when I got home that day, I asked Brian about it, and Brian told me, yes, ma'am, but he didn't really understand what the noose part of it meant. So, you know, and he was like, well, what is that anyway? So, you know, and, you know, we went into detail as to, you know, what it represented or whatever.
What did you tell him?
I said a noose is, and hanging from a tree is normally, you know, how they, you know, done black people or slaves back, you know, a long time ago, you know. And he was like, oh, he said, I didn't know, you know, but he didn't actually see the noose part hanging from the tree.
And so what did they do then after that, the next day?
It was cut off, and like I said, a lot of the parents were complaining. The kids, you know, started bickering about it, you know, towards each other, you know, the black and the white kids. And, you know, we went to the school board, and, you know, media came in, and we discussed it, but they all decided it was just a prank. And then after that, they decided to give the kids 3 days in alternative school. So it was just...
Three days. Now, the principal wanted them expelled, is that right?
Well, when you do anything, it's suggested, you know, for an expulsion hearing. You know, that's just mandatory that they do that. Not per se he felt that way, that's just the, you know, the way they do that, so.
But then he was overridden by
the superintendent, and they got 3 days in school suspension.
And how did you feel about that?
I didn't agree with that. I think, there should have been some more steps taken in that case, you know. It should have been more than just 3 days.
How many students? Were they white students?
Yes,
three
white students.
Mm-hmm. And so then what happened?
After that, you know, it was just a lot of bickering and fussing and complaining, you know, from parents included. And after that, assembly was called, where the DA come in and told the kids, enough is enough. They needed to stop, you know, what they were doing. It was just a prank, and that, you know, if, you know, he could be their best friend or their worst enemy, or he could make their lives go away with the stroke of a pen. So after that, then a series of fights, you know, took place, one being at the Fairborn and one at Gotta Go before the actual fight on December 4th.
And what happened at the Fairborn?
At the Fairborn, Robert Bailey and Ryan Simmons was there, and several white kids, including one that's not even in high school, jumped Robert and beat him up. And when the cops were called, the cops just told him to get back on his side of town. Nobody was charged in that case except for one white guy, which is, you know, a guy that's not in school, and he was only charged with simple battery in that case.
And the next day?
At the next night, Robert and Ryan was at Gotta Go, and one of these same guys that they were into it with the night before seen Robert and him at the store, where they had a few exchange words, and the guy went to his truck and got a gun and pulled on Robert and Ryan. And Robert and him took the gun from the guy and ran with it, and Robert and Ryan was charged with armed robbery, theft over $500 for that. And that white guy was not charged with anything for pulling the gun on them.
And that next day was the fight at school?
December 4th was the fight at school. And my son told me that they were had recess for lunch, and after lunch they were all gathered in the gym because, you know, the main building had burned. So they weren't hanging where they usually hang. They were all in the gym. And the bell rang for them to go back to class. And Bryant say they got up to come outside. As they were coming outside, he was on his way up the stairway when he heard a lick. Him and his girlfriend and several of his friends turned around. He say he jumped up on a rail by the stairway to see if he could see what was going on. And he said that's when he seen Justin laying on the ground. And at that point, he said the teacher was hollering, y'all need to get to class. I'm going to start writing names down. And his girlfriend and several other girls started to proceed towards the fight. And Bryant told his girlfriend and the other ones, let's go to class. You know, somebody's going to get in trouble. So they went on to class. And after that, several of the kids was arrested from school within an hour.
Bryant came home that day and told me that a fight had took place at school and several of the kids was arrested. And, you know, I said, oh, yeah, and he said, yeah, and he named, you know, who some of the kids were that was arrested that day, and he went on to his room. So the next day I was at work, and my auntie came to my job looking for me. And
where do you work?
At LaSalle Nursing Home. And my auntie come up there looking for me, and she told me that Bryant had called and said that he was at the courthouse. He needed me to come down there to see what was going on. So I didn't think it had anything to do with the fight that had the day before. I thought it was something else that had happened at school because so much had been happening. So, but when I got up there, the police officer told me Brian had been charged for kicking Justin, said he was charged with aggravated battery. I said, well, I need to see about bunding him out, and he told me that Brian would have to go before the judge. So that was the next evening. So, and when we went to his bond hearing, that's when we found out the charges had been upgraded to attempted second-degree murder and conspiracy to commit. And they set his bond at $70,000. So Bryant spent 2 nights and 3 days in jail. And we used the bondsman, also used mortgage, you know, the property to get him out of jail. And he's been in Monroe and Dallas ever since then.
Going to high school.
Yeah, he's going to high school in Dallas now.
He was expelled from
Gina High School.
The day after the nooses were hung, did the black students protest under the tree?
Yeah, they just went under the tree, you know, and, you know, talked or whatever, you know.
And when the DA came in and said that he could wipe out their lives with a stroke of a pen, what did Brian think he meant?
I really didn't ask him. I just was so upset with, you know, him threatening the kids, you know, that I didn't even ask him, you know.
Who did Brian think he was targeting, he was talking to?
He felt like he was talking to the black kids.
Even though it was the white kids
right.
that hung the noose.
Right.
So you got Brian out after 2 days,
mm-hmm.
2 nights and 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And how is he now?
He's okay now. He's trying to adjust, you know, to going to school, you know, having to be removed out of the home. You know, that's been a hard thing for him, you know, because it's really just, you know, turned his life upside down, basically, you know, because when, you know, he first got out, he had to, you know, adjust to being in Monroe in a private school. And once he adjusted there over the summer, that school closed. So that's the reason why he had to then go to Dallas to finish his last year of high school there.
How has it affected his older and younger brother?
Well, they miss him a lot, which Derek, he's been out of the home anyway for over a year and a half because he's in college and going to school in Monroe, so he's already been out of the home. But they're affected a lot because, you know, there's always a lot of questions and stuff, so it's kind of hard for them.
How is Brian feeling about facing these attempted murder charges?
It bothers him a lot, but he depends on Mama. He thinks Mama can fix everything, so he's hoping I can help him.
How many years in prison does he face?
Around 80 years or like 80 to life or something like that.
How do you feel?
I don't like it. It upsets me a lot, you know, because my son had absolutely nothing to do with the fight at all, nothing to do with anything that happened prior to that fight. The only thing he's guilty of was going up under an all-white tree. So, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow. And to wake up every morning knowing that the future of your son is in the hands of the DA, that's a horrible feeling.
Tina Jones is Brian Purvis's mother. We're speaking on her front porch in Good Pine, an all-black community in Gina. Brian Purvis was expelled from Gina High School after the fight. He is now living in Dallas with his uncle, Jason Hatcher, who is a Dallas Cowboy, plays professional football. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. The Bush administration is trying to stop the Iraqi government from banning the private military firm Blackwater. Iraqi officials say they've revoked Blackwater's license over a deadly shooting that killed up to 11 civilians. Witnesses say Blackwater guards fired indiscriminately after a car bomb exploded near their convoy. Blackwater's denying wrongdoing and says its guards properly responded to an ambush from insurgents. But Iraqi Interior Minister Jawad al-Bolani called the shootings, quote, a big crime that we can't be silent about. U.S. officials have already gone into overdrive to prevent the banning of Blackwater in Iraq. On Monday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice telephoned Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and vowed an investigation. But the Iraqi government appears to be holding ground. Earlier today, the cabinet said it supports the ban and will review the legal status of all private military companies working in Iraq. The shootout is only Blackwater's latest controversy in Iraq. The North Carolina-based firm operates under a multi-million dollar contract to protect U.S. officials and facilities. It's been allowed close to free rein under a murky legal environment that offers little to no oversight over its operations. The author and independent journalist Jeremy Scahill has been closely following Blackwater. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy joins us here in New York at our Firehouse studio. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Doug Brooks. He's president of International Peace Operations Association, a trade group for the private security industry. Blackwater is a founding member. Let's begin with Doug Brooks. Can you tell us at this point what you know?
We don't know a whole lot, and we've been hearing a lot of different rumors about what exactly happened. But as near as we can tell, there was some sort of ambush in the middle of Baghdad, and one vehicle is disabled, but eventually extracted. But there was a firefight that lasted some 20 minutes in the middle of Baghdad.
Do you know who it was that Blackwater was protecting?
We're not sure. I believe it's State Department, I think, has been what's been reported, but I'm not sure.
Jeremy Scahill, can you respond to the Iraqi government saying they're throwing Blackwater out? And the latest move news is that it looks like they may be looking at the contracts of all of the security companies.
Well, clearly Nouri al-Maliki made the mistake of believing that there is a sovereign Iraqi government for about 15 minutes over the past 24 hours. And it appears now that there's a real diplomatic shuffle going on. Condoleezza Rice called Nouri al-Maliki ostensibly to apologize, but it does seem that the U.S. is putting a tremendous amount of pressure on the Iraqi government not to expel Blackwater. And what's important to understand about this is that Blackwater is a relatively small player in terms of numbers in Iraq. They have about 1,000 operatives on the ground inside of the country. But symbolically, this is of enormous importance because Blackwater is the official mercenary company of the U.S. government. They protect the senior U.S. officials in Iraq, the U.S. ambassador. My understanding is that it was a chief of mission operation that they were protecting yesterday, which could mean that it was a very senior U.S. official that was the principal or the noun, so to speak. But we also have to say that there's nothing new here. Iraqis for 4 years have been terrorized by these mercenaries who ride around the country, and they'll do anything to keep their ever-important U.S. lives protected, even if it means shooting Iraqi civilians. And so if Iraq does follow through on this and expel Blackwater, it would be an extraordinary development.
What is your response to Iraq announcing that they're going to throw out Blackwater, Doug Brooks?
Well, there has to be a process. The Ministry of Interior has sort of been set up several times. There's a licensing process that's incredibly arcane, and right now it takes, 9 months to get a six-month license, which means you have to apply actually for renewal before your license is even approved. And the Ministry of Interior has had some real problems, and so we're not quite sure what's behind this whole thing, but I think these companies are providing a valuable service. I think this terminology of mercenaries, I think if you're a serious researcher, you wouldn't use it. There's a clear international definition of what a mercenary is. These companies are not mercenary. They operate legally. They operate under rules and regulations, and that's as it should be.
Well, Doug, let me just respond to that. Blackwater, which of course is a member company of your association, doesn't just have former Navy SEALs, Delta Force, Special Forces operators. They've hired Colombian soldiers, Chilean soldiers. In fact, Chile is very interesting, Doug, because the Chilean government is actually opposed to the occupation of Iraq. They refuse to join the so-called coalition of the willing, and Blackwater turns around and hires up these Chileans and deploys them in Iraq. It's the very essence of being a mercenary. In fact, it's Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater. It's his definition of mercenary, which is a foreign soldier, a professional soldier who serves a foreign power. And so the fact for money, and the fact of the matter is that Blackwater has hired up soldiers from countries around the world whose home governments are opposed to the war. They are mercenaries. Blackwater is a mercenary company.
May I respond? I actually met some of the Chileans while I was in Baghdad and had a good talk with them. I mean, some of them are mechanics, some of them are drivers for the vehicles. Many of them had been there for several years, basically paying off their houses and paying for their wives' educations and so on. I mean, it's an individual option to do this kind of work.
And they're not mercenaries? Because they're paying their houses off, that doesn't make them mercenaries?
No, because there's an international definition of what a mercenary is, and these are clearly not, these are legitimate entities working over there, and they're valuable.
Doug
essentially,
Brooks,
you need
add,
these sorts of...
What is your definition of a mercenary? What's the international definition?
It's a derogatory, it's a derogatory term. Basically, the international definition, and there's like six parts that weigh into it, but essentially you have to be a mercenary, you cannot have been sent by a government, you cannot be a party of the actual conflict. You cannot be from a country that's a part of the actual actual conflict. Your primary motivation has to be money.
What the Chileans working for Blackwater are, Doug.
Well, no, because in fact they are civilians, and I think one of the real distinctions we need to make is these are
commandos
private security companies. They're not military companies. There are different rules for the military than there are for the civilians. The military has something called rules of engagement. They're secret. Essentially, it says that. It allows the military to be proactive in their responses or in their offensive operations. For the security companies, they have something called Rules for Use of Force, RUF. It's quite different, quite a bit more restrictive, and it essentially it's public, and it boils down to three things. They're allowed to protect themselves, they're allowed to protect whatever they've been contracted to protect, and they're allowed to protect Iraqi civilians under mortal threat, and that's it.
And so often they're also shooting Iraqi civilians. I find it amazing, Doug, that you continue to refer to these heavily armed mercenaries in Iraq as civilians. They are hardly civilians, and there's nothing defensive about what Blackwater is doing in Iraq. Eric Prince's men are at the vanguard of an offensive occupation. You cannot get more offensive than occupying someone else's country. And every time Blackwater engages in a firefight, it's not because the Iraqis are just walking up and shooting at Blackwater. It's because Blackwater is occupying the country along with the U.S. military.
Well, we have some rules here. We have to break for stations to identify themselves, 60 seconds, and then we'll be back with our guests, Doug Brooks, president of the International Peace Operations Association, and Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. We'll be back in a minute. Music by John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the latest news, Iraqi government saying they're throwing Blackwater out of Iraq. We're joined by two people, by Doug Brooks, who heads the International Peace Operation Association, representing companies like Blackwater, which is a founding member, and also Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. I want to talk about the history of Blackwater in Iraq. Jeremy Scahill, let's begin with you.
Well, I think that the most people in the world first learned of Blackwater USA on March 31st, 2004, when four Blackwater operatives were ambushed and killed in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. Their bodies were burned. They were dragged through the streets, strung up from a bridge over the Euphrates River. And the Bush administration responded to that attack by leveling Fallujah and destroying the city. In fact, it was the first of a number of sieges against the city of Fallujah. And it really fueled the Iraqi resistance that haunts the occupation to this day. That was the first time that many people heard of any kind of a private security or private military company, a mercenary company operating in Iraq. And Blackwater has been at the center of a number of pivotal moments in Iraq. In fact, I don't know that there's any other private entity that has had more of an influence on events on the ground in Iraq than Blackwater. A few days after that Fallujah ambush, Blackwater operatives engaged in an all-out firefight with supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr in the Iraqi city of Najaf on April 4th, 2004, once again putting Blackwater in the center of major developments in Iraq. And then in the past year, there have been a number of incidents that not only have impacted Iraqi civilians, but have caused tensions between Baghdad and Washington. Last Christmas Eve, an off-duty Blackwater contractor allegedly shot and killed a bodyguard for the Shiite vice president of Iraq, Adel Abdelmahdi, and the Iraqis are calling that a murder. Blackwater responded to that incident by, they say, firing the contractor and then whisking him out of the country. They say that they were told to do so by the U.S. government. To my knowledge, that individual has not been prosecuted. Blackwater says that they're cooperating with the Justice Department in an investigation over that incident. But we're talking about, I mean, imagine if an Iraqi killed a bodyguard for Dick Cheney at a Christmas party somewhere. I mean, what kind of outrage would there be? And the Iraqis actually kept this under wraps because they felt that if they had released this story and that it became public in Iraq, that it would so outrage the population. How is it that an American can murder a bodyguard for the vice president of the country and apparently nothing happens to them? Then in May, there were back-to-back firefights involving Blackwater on a street outside of the Interior Ministry that drew in U.S. forces and Iraqi forces as well. That also caused an enormous amount of tension between Baghdad and Washington. And then we had this incident that happened over the weekend where we understand eight, as many as 11 perhaps, people were killed in yet another firefight. So Blackwater clearly has been at the center of some very violent moments in Iraq and also appears to be creating some cracks between Washington and Baghdad.
Doug Brooks, we tried to get Blackwater on. They didn't respond to our emails or calls. But who does Blackwater answer to? Under what laws do they operate?
Well, essentially, they're contracted by the U.S. government, so they have they can be held accountable contractually, they can be penalized contractually, their contract can be revoked. After that, you have individual-level accountability, and at this point, they are now under UCMJ, but they're also under MEJA, the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, which essentially says that a person working for a contractor can be brought back to the United States and tried for a felony. Interestingly, it also applies to other nationalities, not including local nationals. So there is that clause as well. This is something that our industry, that IPOA, has actually been working on to improve. The better the accountability, the better it is for our industry. Well, we have companies working around the world. We have companies working in Darfur. We have companies working in Afghanistan. We have companies in Mogadishu, where the U.S. government doesn't even have their own people. So it's important that this accountability aspect be addressed. And we need to look towards the future on this because we are going to be using contractors in the future. It's a critical element to not just Iraq and Afghanistan, but also to peace operations for the UN and Haiti and Congo and so on.
Jeremy Scahill.
Well, right now in Iraq, there are about 180,000 U.S. contractors, according to the Los Angeles Times, operating alongside 165 to 175,000 U.S. troops, which is an enormous force. It's one that the Bush administration does not publicly own. The fact that the U.S. has almost 400,000 personnel occupying Iraq is almost never mentioned by any U.S. government officials. General David Petraeus himself...
If I can weigh in on that point at some point.
General David Petraeus himself said that basically contractors are essential to the survival of the U.S. occupation. So the private sector now is dwarfing the size of the official U.S. military presence in Iraq. And Doug, you know, Doug talks about all of these laws
that?
Under... Hold on a second, Doug. Doug talks
Before
about all of these...
Before we move on to another point, can I clarify the numbers issue?
Go ahead, Doug.
There's of the 180,000, we'll accept the number of 180,000 contractors, but keep in mind most of those are Iraqis, the kind of people you expect or would hope would be doing the security and reconstruction. Also,
right,
keep in mind of the 180,000, many of them are doing the reconstruction work.
Right, this is one of the grotesque realities of the Iraq War. It's very similar to the way multinational corporations operate, where at the top you have the executives of Nike and Disney reaping the profits, and then you hire sweatshop labor on the ground and say, oh, well, we're helping the local economy. And that's exactly what these private war companies are doing in Iraq. But I wanted to respond to what Doug is saying about the accountability issue. Yes, there's a law in the books called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, which in theory provides for the prosecution of contractors who commit a crime in a foreign war zone back inside of the United States. And then because of change in language last year to the Defense Authorization Act, there in theory is the ability to prosecute contractors who work for the Department of Defense under the court-martial system. But the fact of the matter is that we've had tens of thousands of mercenaries go in and out of Iraq. Not a single one has been prosecuted for any crimes against an Iraqi. So either we have tens of thousands of mercenaries running around Iraq who are actually Boy Scouts, or something is fundamentally rotten with the system. And I personally, Doug, do not have faith in the Bush administration's Justice Department to go after these crony corporations of the administration. I mean, we see the politicization of the Justice Department. Do we really believe that they're going to go after Eric Prince's men in Baghdad?
I think we should separate out the sort of political aspect, because essentially these contractors have been working in support of U.S. missions long before the Bush administration. We had 700,000 contractors in World War II. We had 80,000 contractors in Vietnam. In the Bosnia, we had more contractors than soldiers. So we've had these contractors there. It doesn't really matter who the administration is. The contractors bring amazing capacity and capability. My own academic research was in Sierra Leone. There was a handful of contractors supporting the U.N. peacekeeping operation there in 1999 and 2000 when I was there.
Doug Brooks, let me ask you a question.
Moved or fixed or done was being done by contractors.
I think they
play a critical role.
Doug Brooks, can Iraq throw Blackwater out?
It's a good question, because of currently under Iraqi law, which a lot of it comes from the CPA, there's Order 17, which essentially says that the companies, as long as the individuals are on duty, they're actually under U.S. law. So some question as to whether what the process would be and how the Iraqis would do it. So I really can't answer.
Jeremy Scahill.
I mean, the reality here is that every time Iraq has made any kind of noise about prosecuting contractors, the contractors are whisked out. It becomes a major discussion between Washington and Baghdad diplomats. And the fact of the matter is, this is solid proof. There is no sovereignty in Iraq of the government at all. The U.S. gutted out the Iraqi legal system, made it virtually impossible for the Iraqis to hold accountable murderers and thugs inside of the country who are foreign operatives. And so when the Bush administration talks about how great everything is going in Baghdad, we have to remember that when U.S. mercenaries shoot Iraqis, the Iraqis are basically powerless to stop them.
I wanted to play a clip from CNN. Blackwater, of course, is denying the wrongdoing. This clip from CNN yesterday was senior producer Suzanne Simons, who apparently is writing a book on Blackwater. She appeared shortly after you, Jeremy, were interviewed about the shooting.
Now, I'm told by this source that no civilians were actually killed in this incident at all, that all of the people killed were people who were firing on this convoy. And there are even some early reports that some of those people were wearing bits and pieces of Iraqi police uniforms.
That's Suzanne Simons, a CNN senior producer. That's what she was identified as. And she had only originally said that she had a high-level industry source, and that's who her sources were.
Right. I mean, I think this is part of also a long tradition of CNN on behalf of the U.S. government engaging in spin. I mean, what does it mean, a top industry source? I'm not even sure what that phrase means. And, you know, they're basically saying, well, we believe...
She said what she did later say is that you have to take what the Iraqi government says with a grain of salt. She instead had high-level industry sources.
Right. I think this also goes back to the point I was trying to make early on. I think Iraqi officials were under the mistaken impression that they have some degree of sovereignty. And now Condoleezza Rice clearly is reading the riot act to the Maliki government.
What does this mean, Doug Brooks, right now? Not just that Blackwater, Iraq is saying, will throw Blackwater out, but now they're reviewing all of the security companies. What would it mean if Iraq did try to throw Blackwater out? How do they do it?
It's a good question. The reconstruction of a state can be sort of a messy affair, and we see that certainly with the Ministry of Interior and all the problems they've had. I mean, as I mentioned, the whole licensing system is a big problem, and you know, we've had constant issues. The State Department's had constant issues with the Ministry of Interior, and I think you on your own show, and I listen to it on WPFW every morning, you've talked about some of the problems that they've had with the Ministry of Interior. So I think there's a lot of internal issues that have to be sorted out. In terms of their legal system, Jeremy thinks that it's a lot further along in reconstruction than most people, but you wonder if there would be due process for anybody who is put into the Iraqi legal system.
What's the due process for the Iraqis that are gunned down by mercenary companies in Iraq? Where's the due process for the victims of Blackwater and other mercenary companies that you represent?
There is a clear rules for use of force, and when you're in Iraq and you are with these vehicles and military convoys, of course, there's many more of those. You see how the Iraqis behave around them. You allow a lot of space between the convoys and the civilians, and that has to be that way because you have essentially an insurgency that's using suicide vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, so they can move up right next to the convoys and detonate.
No, but my concern
is there's a clear sign on all these. You're operating in a war zone. You're not going to have a sort of a perfect society, and that's an unfortunate reality.
A perfect society. I'm asking you, what's the due process? You're primarily concerned
to civilians.
You're
as well.
Primarily concerned with U.S. lives. U.S. lives are superior to Iraqi lives, and when Iraqis commit the horrible crime of driving their vehicles and get killed, where is the due process for them?
No, I disagree on that point. I think because keep in mind, most of the employees of the security companies, most of the employees of the contractors are Iraqis as well. And one of the key issues of the industry is actually being able to get their people out of Iraq when they're threatened by insurgents.
Let me bring in something here. Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has joined the call for all contracts of foreign security firms to be annulled. He blamed the Iraqi government for failing to protect the Iraqis, noting the shootings occurred on a busy square filled with Iraqi troops. Could this lead to more war?
Well, I mean, this is interesting because Muqtada al-Sadr has been one of the few voices of the Iraqi resistance that has flirted with a unification of Sunni and Shiite groups. And I think what we're seeing here now is a much larger recognition on the part of not only Iraqi politicians, but of the resistance groups, that these mercenary companies are operating all around Iraq. And I do think that we could see an escalation in attacks against these private security operators now that it's becoming a major issue, huge story right now in the Arabic language press.
One question the corporate media doesn't ask. One second, Doug. One question the corporate media doesn't ask is, what are these security firms like Blackwater doing protecting high-level State Department officials? Why isn't it U.S. soldiers who are doing this?
Well, the official theory for it, and Doug, I think Doug and I would agree on this. I mean, the official reason given for this is that it frees up, in theory, the official U.S. military to fight the actual war. And so you contract security from private companies to protect U.S. officials. I see this, though, as a backdoor surge that the Bush administration is engaged in. The deaths of these guys don't get counted. Their crimes don't get prosecuted. Iraqis clearly don't have a means by which to get justice when they're the victims of crimes.
Doug Brooks, you have the last word.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would agree with that particular perspective. But essentially, they do bring a lot of expertise. Most of the Americans that do this sort of thing are experienced veterans. So essentially, you're getting somebody who's already done their time in the military. They have the experience. They're more mature. They tend to be more professional. They train to do this specific
thing. So you're saying that the security firms like Blackwater are more experienced than U.S. soldiers, are better than U.S. soldiers?
In general, absolutely. In general, that's accurate. And, they can go for long periods, for 2 years or 3 years, whereas the military has to rotate their people in and out. And they train particularly for this kind of job. It's different from the military. The military is trained to attack into ambushes, whereas the security companies are trained to get their people out of
there. We're
going
to have to leave it there, but I thank you both very much for being with us. Doug Brooks, head of the International Peace Organization Association in Washington. We're sorry Blackwater didn't respond to our calls. Jeremy Scahill, author of the New York Times bestselling book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And that does it for our show. You can get transcripts or a DVD, audio or video of our broadcast at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Phil Dukadoos, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache, Kizzy Cox, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.